All right, today we're kicking off a brand new series called Bad at Love, and I want to ask you a question as we begin today. Anybody ever get bored and just decide to have some fun with Google? Yeah? I don't know how this became like an American pastime, but Google has become like the way that we stop boredom. But if you know this if you do this, but you can start a sentence or you can start a question on Google and you'll get partway through, and through some sort of algorithm, they determine what's been most popularly searched for or most commonly searched for, and they will often finish your thought. You know what I'm talking about? And so one of the things that you can search for, which I think is really funny, you can go, how many ways, and does anybody know what the top thing that comes up or the first thing to fill in if you put in how many ways? How many ways are there to die? Yeah, I actually heard it from someone, which you have too much time on your hands. But yeah, the top thing is, how many ways are there to die? Which is a really fascinating thing that it says that about our culture, that the most popular Google search that starts with how many ways is how many ways are there to die? Because America and Google are a dark place, I guess, right? And spoiler alert, the answer is there are infinite number of ways to die. Just pick one. And I thought, that's even darker. The answer is even darker than the question. Like, it says something about the answer of the question. But Google will do that, and they'll finish your question, and then they'll give you a number of ways that you can click on and figure out the answer to your question. Well, then a thing that I decided to do as I was preparing for this series a few months ago is I decided to put in to start a question. If you put up the first screen there, the question that I decided to put into Google was, why are Christians so? Anybody feel nervous about what the answer for that could be? I just was like, I want to see what the reputation of Christians, what people are searching for, like how other people are filling in that blank at the end. Why are Christians so? And to get us started and to make us all really, really uncomfortable, make us feel really bad about ourselves, I want to show you the top 12 responses or the ends of that question. Why are Christians so? So if you put up that next screen, the answers to, or the ends of that sentence, why are Christians so negative? Why are Christians so judgmental? Why are Christians so mean? Why are Christians so hypocritical? Why are Christians so angry? Why are Christians so weird? So you guys, you're all weird. Congratulations. Some of you already knew that, and some of you needed to be told, okay? So why are Christians so intolerant? Why are Christians so bad at dating? Which I love that, right? Like, somehow in the top 10 is that we're all bad at dating. Congratulations. Why are Christians so exclusive? Why are Christians so racist? Why are Christians so hateful? And why are Christians so fake? Now, let me ask you this question. Does that list as being our reputation, is there anything really surprising there? Not really. Unfortunately, we have gotten a very bad reputation within society that for whatever reason, through mostly, I think, our own fault, we have gotten some pretty bad reputations or gotten a reputation for some pretty rough stuff. I mean, there's an idea here. Let me kind of go through these. Why are Christians so negative? There's this idea that Christians, we see the negative side of things, that we choose to see the negative side of things, that we look at the world and we focus on the negative, and we say things like, well, the whole world is going to hell in a handbasket. And you're like, if you're going to hell, why are you going in a handbasket? That doesn't even, what is a handbasket? I mean, I don't even know what that sentence really means, but that we think the worst is going to happen. We assume the worst is going to happen, and that somehow we're all going to be involved and we're going to all drag each other to the worst possible conclusion. Why are Christians so judgmental? Let me just ask you this question. Anybody in the room ever felt judged by a Christian? I mean, like, let's be honest. As Christians, we have a reputation of being pretty judgmental, of being people who say, like, look, I have a standard, and if you don't live up to it, I'm going to judge you. And you're going to feel like I'm going to talk in a condescending way, and I'm going to talk as if you're stupid, because if you were smart, you would have figured out how to live like me. We have a reputation for being pretty judgmental. We have a reputation for being mean. And mean would simply mean that, like, okay, it's not just negative and it's not judgmental. Like, you're actually intentionally being, you're not accidentally being these things. You're intentionally being these things, and you're intentionally being these things at me. In other words, you're not just trying to, like, live your lives and, oops, someone got hurt. Like, you were actually trying to hurt someone intentionally. Why are Christians so hypocritical? In other words, we've done a pretty good job of getting our message out and making sure that people understand how Christians are supposed to live and what Christians are supposed to believe. And the world looks at us and goes, okay, well, I understand what you believe, and I know how you're supposed to behave because you're telling me it's how I'm supposed to behave. But if we're being honest, you don't even live up to that. So there's a difference between what you believe about and how you behave and what you claim you're supposed to behave and how you're actually behaving. That's what we call hypocrisy. And the world views us as being pretty hypocritical. Why are Christians so angry? In other words, the world views us that Christians aren't just like starting at neutral, that Christians are kind of starting on edge, and it doesn't take much to set us off. Why are Christians so weird? I mean, let's be honest. I can get that one. I understand that one. We believe weird things, right? We believe a dude died and then rose himself from the dead. We believe in a thing called the Holy Spirit, which gives spiritual gifts, which are abilities that help you in life and in ministry and make things possible that aren't supposed to be possible. We believe in things like that. We believe in some weird things, and therefore sometimes we do some weird things. And we behave in ways that sometimes actually do come off as very weird and very different from the rest of the way the world lives. So I totally get weird, and I'm all on board for being weird because I think there's some normal things that I don't really want to have anything to do with, okay? Now, the second, well, we're going to go on to the second part of the list. Why are Christians so intolerant? There's an idea that Christians don't play well with others, right? That we don't tolerate well other beliefs. We don't tolerate other belief systems. We don't tolerate people who believe and view the world differently than we believe. And let's be honest, if you've been a Christian for a while, you know that even within Christianity, there's like different sets of beliefs. And there's like, you know, I believe this, you know, this, I kind of follow the teachings of this church or this church or this church. And if this, and this church doesn't play well with this church, you know what I'm talking about? And so if this and this group doesn't play well with this group, so I'm a part of this group and I don't really play well with you because I'm kind of intolerant, even of other Christians who have a different bent than I have. Why are Christians so bad at dating? I'm not going to try to answer that one. We're just going to come back someday and we'll just do like a two-week series on why Christians are bad at dating and we'll try to get you good at dating. Let's go on. Why are Christians so exclusive? This idea that, well, Christians, we believe that there is one way to God, one way to heaven, and that anyone else is, it just feels like they're excluded. And we can say, like, wait, I do believe there is an exclusive way to a Savior, but I believe everyone has an option and should be included in that. I don't want Christianity to be exclusive. I believe that Jesus is exclusive. He's the only way, but I don't ever want someone else to feel excluded because of me. But we've gotten the reputation that not only is Jesus exclusive, or not only is Christian, not only are Christians exclusive, but Jesus is also exclusive. So we've made this thing that shouldn't be. Why are Christians so racist? And this one makes me uncomfortable. Well, let me just be honest. This one makes me uncomfortable because I know the church should be ashamed of our past with this. I know the church has, unfortunately, racism in the history. And I know all too many churches have it in their current DNA. I know that there are Christians who use the Bible to justify slavery and to justify all kinds of racism in the name of Jesus, you know, and we've twisted and taken some things to treat people horribly. And we don't cross lines well, and we don't play well with others, and we don't play with others, especially if they don't look like us. So why are Christians so racist? Why are Christians so hateful? In other words, why does it seem like Christians, they start angry and mean, and when someone is different from them and they can't understand, their response is not to put a posture on and go, help me understand. Their posture is to attack. Why do Christians attack? Why are Christians so fake? In other words, even when we try to be genuinely and loving, it seems like we have to work too hard. You know what I'm talking about? So why are Christians so negative, judgmental, mean, hypocritical, angry, weird, intolerant, bad at dating, exclusive, racist, hateful, and fake? And that's the reputation that we have today. So the second you become a Jesus follower, you pick up a reputation. And if you call yourself a Christian to someone who is not a Christian, chances are in their mind, they think, oh, it's weird. I didn't know you were so negative and judgmental and mean and hypocritical and fake. I mean, when you think about it, that being the top 12, nothing good comes on the list till like number 18. We've gained a pretty negative reputation. We've gotten a reputation for some things that are pretty negative. And you would think, based on the fact that this is our reputation in the world that we live in, you would think that like somewhere along the way, Jesus must have had like a side meeting with his guys, right? Because there's all the stuff that's recorded in scripture, but somewhere along the way, it almost seems like it must be true that Jesus must have had like a side meeting where like, yeah, hey guys, there's all that stuff I said in public about like loving, 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 because that's like a really good message. Everyone could get on board with that. But here's how I want you to live going forward. Don't put this in the Gospels. But just make sure that everyone knows this is the real meaning of Christianity. I want you to be really negative. I want you to just judge everyone, be really mean and attack people who are different than you. Also, if you could throw in a little bit of racism, and by the way, be bad at dating. It almost would seem like Jesus somewhere along the way had a meeting with the guys to explain this is really what it means to follow him. And we would say like, you know, I know what Jesus taught, but what we have lived out is far different. I mean, again, so how is it possible that we have gained a reputation for these 12 things that seem to be so the opposite of what Jesus taught? And in case you're wondering, like, is that really the opposite of what Jesus taught? Let me give you a few examples of what Jesus taught. In Matthew chapter 22, Jesus said this, someone asked, teacher, which is the most important? Would you say most important? Which is the most important commandment in the law of Moses? Okay, so I want one thing. Would you say one thing? I want one thing. Jesus replied, you must love the Lord your God. And he's like, ah, got my one thing. You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And he's like, cool, got my one thing. And then Jesus is like, hold on, don't walk away yet. He said, a second is equally important. Would you say equally important? A second is equally important. And the second thing that's equally important, love your neighbor as yourself. And you're like, that's fine. I don't really love myself that much. No, we do. You may not like yourself, but we all know how to love ourselves. We look out for ourselves. We care for ourselves. We make sure ourselves are fed. We make sure ourselves have heat and light and energy. I mean, like, we take good care of ourselves even if we don't like ourselves. We know how to love ourselves. And Jesus said, a second is equally important. So there's love the Lord your God with your whole heart, your whole mind, everything in you. And just as important to Jesus is love your neighbor. He says you can't separate one from the other. These are not two separate ideas. This is both and. This is not either or. This is both and. This is love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law, he says, the entire law and all the demands of the prophets are based on these two commandments. He says, okay, so you got 39 Old Testament books. Two things matter. Love the Lord your God, love your neighbor. That's what mattered to Jesus. Love God, love people. And they cannot be divided, and they cannot be separated, and one is not more important than the other. These are equally important to Jesus. Then Jesus said in Luke chapter 6, verse 27, he said this, but to you who are willing to listen, I say, love your enemies. Now, let me ask this, because I just want to ask us to say this, but I don't want you to say it like, because when we say things like this, we're like, well, love your enemies. I want you to just shout this like you're actually happy about it, okay? So on the count of three, we're all just going to shout, love your enemies. Ready? One, two, three. Love your enemies. Yeah. Some of you, you couldn't even say it loudly with a smile on your face. I mean, it's like, love your enemies. My enemies, those Cowboys fans, they're terrible. I mean, like, the enemies. They're not just my enemies. They're the enemies of God. You know, like he says, look. To you who are willing to listen, I say, love your enemies. Then he says, do good to those who hate you. What? Bless those who curse you. What? Pray for those who hurt you. Huh? I'm trying to go higher pitch. That's all I got. Pray for those who hurt you. If someone slaps you on the cheek, offer the other cheek also. And I just want to clarify, he didn't specify face or backside. So wherever, whichever cheek someone slaps, you're just like, hey, here's the other one. I mean, like, if someone slaps you on the cheek, you offer the other also. I don't know. I mean, that's just comic relief right there. I don't know if that's actually true. If someone slaps you on the one cheek, offer the other also. If someone demands your coat, offer your shirt also. Give to anyone who asks, and when things are taken away from you, don't try to get them back. Do to others as you would like them to do to you. So Jesus' idea of love is, look, you don't respond in kind to how they treated you. You treat them with love no matter what. However they have treated you, you show love. If they have been horrible to you, you show love. If they have been terrible people to you, you show love. If their words have actually damaged your reputation, you show love. You show love. And what Jesus did here, he does two things. He raises the standard of what our love is supposed to look like. Your love is bigger than their actions towards you. Your love is regardless. Your love is regardless. Your love is not determined by their actions to you. You set the tone. He raises the standard, and then he widened the circle. He said, you think you only have to love the people who love you in return. And I want you to love people who hate you. And I want you to love people who are actively working against you. And I want you to love your enemies. And I want you to pray for their good. I want you to work for their benefit. He raised the standard and he widened the circle of love. Then his followers, a guy named Paul, he wrote a whole bunch of the New Testament. Here's what he said in Romans chapter 13. He said, owe nothing to anyone except for your obligation to love one another. So he says, look, you don't really have any obligations in Christianity. You owe God your life. But the way that God wants your life is that you would love one another. God wants your life. You owe God your life. The way you're going to give God your life is to love one another. Love one another. Love one another. If you love your neighbor, he says, you will fulfill the requirements of God's law. Love does no wrong to others, So love fulfills the requirements of God's love. He echoes Jesus. Look, there's this whole Old Testament that we've all believed in and that we thought was really good and we thought was really beneficial and we thought it connected us to God. But let me tell you, Paul would say, and Jesus would say, if you love one another, you have fulfilled everything about the Old Testament. If you love one another, everything from the Old Testament fulfilled if you love one another. Galatians chapter 5. Paul says one more thing. He says, for in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. And for a Jewish audience, they would be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. That's like all that's mattered for a long time. That has had the only thing that had any value. That's the only way we knew who was connected to God and who was not connected to God. And you're saying that has no value whatsoever? And then he says, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Let me ask you, how many things mattered to Jesus? The only thing, how many things matter? It's not the only things. It is the only thing that matters. The only thing that counts. The one thing that matters above every other thing. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through what? Love. So here's the thing. We have a reputation that is far, 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 far away from love. And yet Jesus taught love. So the question that I want to ask today, and I think we have to wrestle to the ground, how on earth, how in the world did Christians get a reputation for being so bad at the one thing that Jesus was most concerned with us being good at? How did Jesus' followers get so bad at love when love was the one thing that mattered most to Jesus? How did we get so bad at this? How did we miss this? Where did we miss this? How did we get to the point where our actions are so the opposite of love that Google names the top 16 things in the world that Christians are known for as the opposite of love? How did we get here? How did we get to that place? I mean, I think there's a couple ideas, and I know there's a couple arguments we could make that would kind of, you know, justify this. We could make the argument that, like, hey, well, you know, there's sometimes you can be trying to love someone and they don't feel love. I mean, we can make that argument. You could say, you know, hey, we're trying to speak the truth because people need the truth, and the most loving thing we can do is to speak the truth. And if people didn't feel loved on the other side of that, that's their problem. We could say a lot of those things, and we would still have missed the point that we have not been loving. And here's the thing, I think there's a couple things that we have done that have caused us to not be good at love, that have caused us to be bad at love. The easy answer is for us to say, well, you know what, no one's perfect. Anybody ever said that about yourself? Like, yeah, no one's perfect. Here's the thing, you know when you hear that from someone else, you know they are letting themselves off the hook. And so if we say, well, hey, you know, I know I'm called to love, but no one's perfect, what we're really doing is letting ourselves off the hook for our unloving behavior. That's the easy answer. That's the easy way out. And honestly, when people look at us and hear us say, well, you know, we're called to love, but no one's perfect, they just go, you are just letting yourselves off the hook for not following Jesus. So that's the easy answer that we're not going to settle for. The second thing is a little more honest, and it's, if we're honest, I think most of us would say, if you're a Jesus follower, what you know to be true of you, and I know it's true of me in a lot of times, is that we've been guilty of trying to combine a lot of me with a little bit of Jesus. And so we're carrying around the name of Jesus follower, but we're really showing the world a lot of Chris. You know what I'm talking about? And so it really depends on how Chris is feeling that day and what kind of morning Chris had, and how what you're going to experience of Jesus really is really what you're going to experience of Chris. You know what I'm talking about? And so people have felt unloved because Chris is showing through more than Jesus is showing through. And we haven't really let Jesus affect every area of our lives, the way we talk, the way we think, the way we treat people, the way we act towards people who are different from us. We haven't let that shine through and affect our lives. We're still carrying around a lot of us, and people are experiencing more us than they're experiencing Jesus. And here's the brutally honest answer, is simply this, that we're all much better at being religious than we are at actually following Jesus. We're all way better, if we're honest, we're all way better at Sunday Christianity than we are at Monday Christianity. We're all far better at coming together and singing songs on Sunday than we are at walking into work on Monday, seeing the person that we don't like and being actually nice to them. We're far better at coming together and like, oh man, we're all Christians. Yay, we all like each other. Yay, fake smiles on my face. Than actually going into work on Tuesday with a boss who you think has made your life miserable and actually showing respect. We're far better at being religious than we are at following Jesus. Because what Jesus said was the most important thing, the only thing that counts, is love one another. Is love one another. So here's the thought that I want to make today, and we're going to talk a little bit more about how this looks, but I want to make sure we get this in our brain, and I want this to bother us to the point where we change, where we grow, and where we get different from this. But the simple bottom line for the series is simply this, that you can't be good at following Jesus while being bad at love. We can't be good at following Jesus while being bad at love. In other words, I can't be good at following God and loving the Lord with all my heart while being terrible towards my neighbor. I can't be good at following Jesus while having conflict with someone that I refuse to resolve because I won't get in a room and have a conversation with them. We can't be good at following Jesus while being bad at loving each other and loving other people. We can't be good at following Jesus while being bad at love. And I hope that bothers us, because for far too long, we have been bad at love. And we've been really good at love, at thinking we love God. And we've been very bad at loving our neighbors and being loving towards the people around us. So for the next few weeks, we're going to talk about how we get better at love, how we get better at loving other people, how we stop being bad at love and start being good at the thing that Jesus said was most important. Now, in case you're like, well, okay, Chris, you picked four verses from the New Testament that all seem to be about love. That's really nice. That's cute. But, like, I mean, those are just four verses. I want to read today, in our last couple minutes together, I want to read from the episode where Jesus was having his last few moments with his guys, with his 12 disciples. I mean, Jesus spent 3.5 years with these guys doing ministry in and around Jerusalem. And in this moment, the Bible records it as the Last Supper. But to these 12 guys, at this time, it was just supper. Jesus knew what was about to come. Jesus knew he was about to be betrayed. He was about to be arrested. He was about to go to trial. And he was about to die an unjust death. He knew all of that. These guys knew none of it. Jesus knew that this moment was those final last words. Like, I've got to say what matters most. I've got to say what's most important. I got to make sure that these guys know what to do based on everything we've talked about for the last 3.5 years. I've got to give them the final summary. And so Jesus begins talking. He begins talking and sharing life and sharing this meal and talking and teaching. And Jesus kind of went into this different mode that was like, okay, hey, you, everybody, here's what you got to say. Here's what you need to understand. Like, he went into like super fast talking mode. I'm like, guys, we got to get this because I got to go to, like, you don't even know, but I got to go to a cross. Like, what? You got to go to a cross? Yeah, you got to get this. 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 And so in the middle of that conversation, in John chapter 13, verse 34, Jesus says this. So now I'm giving you a new commandment. A new commandment. And for them, they'd grown up with 10 commandments. And they'd grown up with a whole bunch of other laws. And they're like, you're giving us, like, you're adding to Moses. Like, you're going to give us an 11th commandment. And then Jesus says, I'm giving you a new commandment. Love each other. And they're like, cool. Jesus, that's kind of anticlimactic, because we've heard you talk about love like a whole bunch of times. This is not new. This is not a new thing. Like, we've heard you talk about it like day one, day two, day three. And like, for the last 3.5 years, you've been talking about love. Like, we get it. He says, I'm giving you a new commandment. Love each other. And then he says, hold on, before you jump to a conclusion, here's the new part. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other. And I'm just going to be honest, I don't think they understood what this meant in this moment. I don't think they understood how he had loved them. So he goes on in verse 35, he says this, your love for one another, it's going to prove to the world that you are my disciples. But they didn't understand what it looked like for them to love others the way they had been loved by him. They didn't understand at that moment what just as I have loved you meant. They didn't understand that for Jesus, just as I have loved you, loving them meant leaving the goodness of heaven, and they didn't understand that yet. They didn't know, and they didn't understand that loving them meant setting aside his rights as the Son of God, as perfect. They didn't realize that loving them meant setting aside the perfection of heaven to experience the imperfection of earth. They didn't understand that loving them meant unthinkable and undeserved pain, and they didn't know that loving them meant the ultimate sacrifice of actually giving of his last breath. They didn't know that that's what him loving them meant. They hadn't seen it yet. They hadn't understood it yet. They didn't understand the cost that Jesus meant when he said, just as I have loved you, that's my expectation of how you'll love each other. He said, just as I have loved you, you're going to love one another. That's my new commandment. That's the one commandment. That's the one thing that I'm going to say above everything else, is that you would love each other, and that you would love each other the same way that I have loved you. And then he says, look, guys, your love, it's going to be the proof that you are actually my disciples. In other words, instead of people looking and going like, wow, those Christians, why are those Christians so negative and critical and mean and mean-spirited and judgmental? I mean, like, instead of all of that, people should be looking at us and going like, wow, those people are so genuine with their love for each other. That kind of love, it can only come from people who know Jesus. That's what people should see when they look at us. Or man, those people are so generous. Like when anyone has a need in their midst, like there's like, it's like a line coming up to like try to be the first to get to meet the need. That's how, like those people are just so generous to each other. They must be Christians. That's what Jesus said. That's what Jesus' hope was. That people would be so generous in his name, so loving in his name, so genuine in his name, that other people would recognize it and go, well, that only happens for people who know Jesus. Your love for each other, for one another, will prove to the world that you are my disciples. So about a half hour goes by in dinner. And like, again, these guys didn't know that this was the last time they were going to spend time with Jesus. They didn't realize the moment they were in. So they just kind of like, cool, yeah, okay, it's a new commandment. We're going to love each other the way you've loved us. Okay, that's sweet. Can we have our steak now? Like, you know, like they just kind of like moved on. And Jesus keeps talking about some other stuff, but he realizes through the night and through some other conversations that come up and through some different arguments that happen in the middle of this thing, he realizes these guys haven't gotten it yet. They haven't picked up on exactly what I'm talking about. So I need to reiterate. Like Jesus knows that sometimes he has to repeat things because we need to learn some things. So Jesus repeats, he goes back. He's like, okay, you guys have missed this. You missed this. He goes back. Come back, guys. He says, I have loved you even as the Father has loved me. Then he says, remain in my love. And he says, when you obey my commandments, which by the way, what's Jesus' one commandment? Love each other. He says, when you obey my commandments, you remain in my love. In other words, when we love each other, Jesus' love flows to us. And as Jesus' love flows to us, because we've been loved, we are more able to love other people. As you follow my commandments, you remain in my love, just as I obey my Father's commandments and I remain in his love. I have told you these things, he said. I have told you these things so that you will be filled with my joy. Yes, your joy will overflow. This is my commandment. Love each other in the same way I have loved you. There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. And then he did it. And then he laid down his life for his friends. He said, there's no greater love than to lay down your life for your friends. And then he laid down his life for those he loved. He said, this is my command. Love each other. Go back to verse 12. Because I just want to make sure we don't miss this. Because some of us, we need to read things pretty slow. Verse 12. This is my commandment. Love each other in the same way I have loved you. Do I need to go a little slower? I can. This is my commandment. Love each other in the same way I have loved you. Love each, let's break down each word. Love each other in the same way that I have loved you. Love each other with a sacrificial love. Love each other with a love that isn't depending on how the other person acts towards you. Would you just love each other, and would you love everyone you come in contact with in the same way that I have loved you? See, what Jesus says is simply this. The primary way that Jesus wants us to show our love for him is by loving those he loves. That's our calling. If you're a follower of Jesus, that's the game. That's the game changer. That's what moves us away from being bad at love towards actually being good at love, towards not only loving God and not only loving the Lord our God with all our hearts and all our mind, but to actually loving the Lord our God by doing what he wants to do when we love other people. The primary way that Jesus wants us to show our love for him is not by loving him. The primary way he wants to show our love for him is by doing what he says and loving each other. And loving those he loves. Now, let me ask you this question. Who does Jesus love? Everyone. Who's Jesus love? Who did Jesus die for? Who did Jesus love so much that he left heaven, lived as one of us, and died for all us? Who does Jesus love that much? Everyone. So who are we required to love? Everyone. Let's try, because we're not all playing along here. Who does Jesus love that much? So who are we called to love? Now again, about half of your plans. We're going to try one more time. Who does Jesus love so much that he would lay down his life and die on a cross for?
Everyone.
Who are we called to love?
Everyone.
The primary way Jesus wants us to show our love for him is by loving those he loves, and he loves everyone. So that's our calling to love everyone, to show love to everyone. Now you think, okay, like, so I think I'm okay at loving. Like, what does love look like? What should love look like? What does this kind of love look like? What does love look like if it's the only thing that matters and I have to get it right? What does love look like? I think a couple words. The first one, and I was hesitant to use this word because I know it has so many different meanings, but the first one is desegregated. So I know that word carries a whole bunch of different terms, but in our world today, I think when it comes to our world, we are not moving towards being united. We're moving towards being more segregated and more divided. We have far more lines between people today than we've ever had in our entire world. We have lines based on political beliefs, based on geographical beliefs, based on skin color stuff. I mean, we have so many different, like, if someone's like, hey, I love McDonald's. Well, I love Burger King. I hate you now. I mean, like, we have so many different things that divide us from other people that we have so many lines that we say, like, well, I'm not willing to cross that line. We have this, like, we don't share this thing in common, therefore I can't show them love. And I just want to remind us that love does not segregate itself from someone. Love doesn't allow a line to be a limit to love. Love says, look, and also, let me just say this. Love doesn't erase the line and disregard the line so that it can love the person on the other side. Love respects the line and says, hey, I respect that about you, and I'm still going to choose to walk over the line to show love to you. Does that make sense? So here's a question that I think we have to understand in the context of the world that we live in. Can you love someone, and can you genuinely show love and kindness to someone who's on the other side of the aisle politically from you? If you're a Republican, can you actually show kindness and love to someone who's a Democrat? If you're a Democrat, can you actually show love to someone who's on the other side of the aisle from you? Can you genuinely show love and kindness to someone who's on the other side of the gun control debate? Can you actually show love to someone who's different than you? Can you actually show love to someone who's of a different color than you? Can you actually show love to someone who believes that your favorite restaurant is not the best restaurant in the entire world? Can you show love to people who disagree with you? My pastor that I worked for when I was a youth pastor, he said this: it's an art form to disagree without being disagreeable. It is possible to love without agreeing about everything. And if we think we have to agree before we can love, we will never love. So let's just decide we don't have to agree to love. Let's desegregate our love. Second thing is, we want to love in a way that's regardless. In other words, I know how someone has treated me, and I know what they deserve, but I'm going to choose to give them better than what they deserve. Does that make sense? So regardless of how someone has treated me, Jesus has called me to live at a high standard of love, and I'm going to live up to Jesus' standard of love, not their standard of behavior. Does that make sense? I want to love regardless. I want to love regardless. And then finally, I want to love sacrificially. And sacrificially simply means this, that if love has not cost you something, it may just be convenient kindness. Love, real love, always costs us something. Real love always costs us something. And until we're willing to sacrifice, it may be true that we have not really loved someone. Until love has cost us our time, until love has cost us some money, until love has cost us an inconvenience, until love has inconvenienced us, it is very possible that we just have not really loved. Real love sacrifices. Real love from a loving God costs a sacrifice of his perfect, sinless Son, because love is sacrificial. So here's the thing. Again, everywhere Jesus went, he raised the standard of love and he widened the circle of love. He raised the standard. This is how you're supposed to love, even though you've seen far worse. This is how you're supposed to love. This is how you're supposed to love. It's a far bigger calling than what you think. And then he widened the circle of who was worthy of love. He said, it's not about being worthy. It's just you love everyone. Well, they treated me terrible. You love them. Well, they actually slapped me in the face. You love them. Give them the other cheek. I mean, they literally took my coat. Did you have a shirt to give them? Why didn't you give them your shirt? You love them. Well, they're my enemy. You pray for them. Jesus widened the circle so that everyone was deserving of the love of his followers. So the question that I want us to ask throughout the rest of this series, and the question that I hope just bothers you and bugs you, and maybe bugs you enough that we're all willing to take a step, and bugs us all enough, and it's going to bug me a lot, and it's already bugged me this morning because I failed at this before I even left the house. But I hope this question bothers us enough that we actually make some progress. So here's the question I want us to ask ourselves for the next month in all kinds of different situations. It's simply this question. What is the most loving thing I could do? What is the most loving thing I could do? Not how do I just respond in kind to what they did? Not what's the bare minimum that I can do and still be loving? Not how should I treat them based on how they treated me? But simply, what is the most loving thing I could do? If Jesus has set a high bar for love, how do I clear it? I want to do what's the most loving thing that I can do. So on the count of three, let me just ask you, can we try this together? And let me just tell you, we're going to do this as long as it takes to get everybody participating, so we can do it once or we can do it 100 times. So on the count of three, ready? 1, 2, 3. What is the most loving thing I could do? That was about half participation, so we're going to do it one more time, okay? 1, 2, 3. What is the most loving thing I could do? That's pretty good. I think some of you guys are just moving your lips, but we'll move on, okay? What is the most loving thing I could do? Again, not just clearing the minimum bar, not responding in kind. What's the most loving thing that I could do? What's the most loving thing I could do to my husband, to my wife, to my kids, to my neighbors, to my coworkers, to the people my kids are playing Little League with or with soccer leagues? I mean, what's the most loving thing I can do to people I like, to people I don't really like, to people I get along with, to people I don't get along with, to people who are on the same side of most issues as me, and to people who are on the opposite side of most issues as me? What is the most loving thing I could do? We're just going to ask that question. And I want you to ask that question. You may need to ask it every hour of the day. You may need to just remind yourself one time at the beginning of the day and go, hey, what's the most loving thing I could do? God, help me to remember that as I make decisions throughout the day. What's the most loving thing I could do? For some of us, that answer is already kind of like, there's already an answer in your heart about a certain situation, but there's all kinds of situations we need to ask ourselves this question in. And it's going to land in a million different places. But just to give you a little bit of a start as you think about this, what is the most loving thing that I can do? For some of us, it may be that we actually need to be quiet and listen when we'd rather be loud and give answers. For some of us, the most, like, we have been doing what's natural, and we've been talking, answer. And sometimes people just really need someone to listen to them. And they need to know that they've been heard. And they will not know that they've been heard if your mouth keeps moving. So as hard as it might be, for some of us, the most loving thing that we can do is to go, oh, I made it 5 seconds. That was great. You know, like, it may be really difficult, but for some of you, the most loving thing that you can do is to be quiet and listen when you would rather be loud and give answers. For some of us, it's the most loving thing that we can do is to be patient when it would be more natural for us to push another person to move at our pace. I mean, for some of us, we have our pace, and we want everyone to move at our pace. And Jesus says, you know what? The most loving thing that you could do would actually be to let them move at their pace and not push them. And not try to change them and mold them and push them into your image. I created them in my image. So why don't you let them move at their pace? For some of us, the most loving thing that we could do would be to be slow to judgment when it would be natural and it's easy for us to jump fast to a conclusion about someone or about some group. We say, like, well, okay, I know I naturally want to rush to judgment, but I'm going to sit back and I'm going to want to try to understand instead. I don't want to rush to a judgment. For some of us, the most loving thing that we could do would be to treat someone today like you're still working to make a great first impression. Let's be honest, for some of us who are husbands and wives, we're a ways away from that first date. And we knew how we treated on the first date, and we dressed up, and we wore cologne, and we, you know, ladies, you actually did your hair, and no one was wearing sweatpants, and you look at life, and you're now 7 years down the road, or 15 years down the road, and you're thinking, wow, I haven't done my hair in forever, I'm only wearing sweatpants, and I don't think this shirt's clean. Date night? I mean, like, it's just, you know. And we're no longer trying to make a good impression. And we're no longer trying to show love. And for some of us, the most loving thing that we could do for our spouse is to return to that place where you go, you know what? I'm going to treat you today, 15 years in, 20 years in, 4 years in, however long it's been, I'm going to treat you like I'm still trying to win you over. For some of us, the most loving thing that we could do is actually to have a loving, difficult conversation with someone when it's more comfortable for you to stay quiet. You know, I'm just going to pray. And sometimes God's like, hey, I want you to have a conversation because they're not listening to me, but they might listen to you. For some of us, the most loving thing is to actually have that conversation. And for some of us, this is the most difficult one. The most loving thing we could do would be to actually let someone experience the consequences of their choices. For some of us, we have a compassionate streak that is like, I'll bail you out. And they never feel the consequences of their choices or their actions. And what we're doing is actually enabling their irresponsibility. And the most loving thing that we could do would be to say, hey, you know what? I'm not bailing you out anymore. Eventually, you need to learn the consequences of your choices. And that's difficult. And that's tough. But that's also really loving sometimes. So what's the most loving thing we can do? What's the most loving thing I can do? What's the most loving thing that you can do? Across a bunch of situations, across your family, across your workplace, across your school, what is the most loving thing that we can do? Because that is what Jesus requires of you. What's the most loving thing that we can do? What's the most loving thing we can do? And if we'll ask that question, and if we'll wrestle it to the ground, this is how we start to turn the tide. If only with our church, and if only with our circle of influence, this is how maybe in our city we start to turn the tide. Of instead of being viewed as being incredibly bad at love, we could become known for being good at the thing that Jesus said was most important, of really genuinely loving our neighbors and really genuinely loving each other. That's what we're called to. So let's start. Let's start today. Let's start with that lunch. Let's start with this afternoon. Let's start with tonight when you're with some people that you like and when you're with some people that you don't like. What's the most loving thing that I can do? And then you do that thing. You ask the question and you do that thing. You ask the question and you do that thing. That's how we start to turn the tide. Now, again, this falls in a whole bunch of different places, and I don't know where it's going to land for every individual, but I know for all of us, there are three things and three ways that this lands. And that's where we're going to pick it up next week. Next week is going to be amazing, and you're going to love it. In 2 weeks, it's going to be terribly uncomfortable, and you're going to hate it. And then then 3 weeks from now, we're going to make it really great again. But we got some work to do. And we've got some ways that we need to change. So let's ask the question, what is the most loving thing that I could do? Let's pray.